You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Mompox, Colombia. That's 5 hours south from Cartagena in Colombia's Caribbean region. And this is episode 384 of the Columbia Calling podcast. Some pretty exciting news for you guys out there and, of course, for us here. The Columbia Calling podcast have been nominated in 4 categories of the Latin Podcast Awards this year. We've been nominated for Podcast of the Year, Best Podcast Out of Colombia, Best Podcast in English, and Best Society and Culture Podcast. So very exciting to be nominated alongside so many great other podcasts. None of this would be available without the dedicated work of our journalist, Emily Hart, who provides the newscast every week and provides news for you about Colombia. And of course, this episode is really about her, because she comes back not only in segment 2, bringing you the news this week, but also in segment 3 to discuss life as a journalist in Colombia. And guess what? She's here too in Mompox. So over a beer, we have a little natter, and you're going to enjoy it because it's a lot of fun. So don't go away. Stay tuned and listen to myself and Emily Hart have a chat between journalists here in Mompox over a beer. Bye-bye.
I'm Emily Hart, and these are your top news stories for the week of July 12th, 2021. The Organization of American States has published its much-anticipated report on the actions of the Colombian government during the last 2 months of national protest and unrest. In a 48-page document, the body condemned the disproportionate use of force, gender-based violence, ethnic-racial violence, violence against journalists and against medical missions, and reports of disappearances, as well as the use of the military. One of the report's most controversial assertions was that roadblocks are a legitimate protest mechanism and therefore are protected under the constitutional right to protest. The report also criticized attempts to censor information around the protests and the lack of clarity around the numbers of the dead and missing. The Attorney General's office documents 21 deaths in protests. Local organizations put the figure at more than 70. Iván Duque's government reacted by questioning the commission's mandate and the report's method of contrasting and acquiring sources. Several recommendations were made to the Colombian government, including prohibiting the use of lethal force as a means of controlling public order and the separation of the police from the Ministry of Defense. Though in most countries in the world the police are governed by the Ministry of the Interior or equivalent, in Colombia they fall under the Ministry of Defense's mandate, in part a remnant of the civil conflict in which police assimilated military structures and training, as well as a product of the police's ongoing frontline role in tackling drug trafficking. The report may have political and reputational implications, but the recommendations are not binding and do not imply sanctions if disregarded. Meanwhile, Colombia has become the unlikely center of the assassination of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse, who was killed in his home in the country's capital last week. Reports are conflicting and many key details remain murky. Local police say the president was killed by a group of 28 foreign mercenaries, including more than 20 Colombians, all former soldiers with extensive special forces training and recently retired. It is still unclear who organized the attack and with what motive. Of the 28, the majority are now in detention, at least 3 have been killed, and the rest remain at large. Some of the group reportedly arrived through the Dominican Republic, others through Panama around a month earlier. Police have also identified 4 companies that paid for the air tickets and accommodation on the island for the group, but have not revealed further details, nor is it clear whether or not there was a signed contract. The group claimed they were not given information about their assignment. Some have reported the group were actually there to protect the president, who had many enemies and had announced a plot on his life earlier in the year, having reportedly not left his home since February. Some say they arrived at the residence after the assassination, having heard a report of the shooting. Others are saying he was killed by his own security, while his wife, who was injured in the attack, rejects this theory. None of the president's security guards were injured during the attack. After several decades of armed conflict, Colombian military personnel have been highly trained and have become a sought-after commodity in the mercenary market. With poor to non-existent state support for the country's many retired military personnel, there are many former soldiers from Colombia who end up as mercenaries abroad, hired by private firms and security operations, some legal actors, others not. Job offers often circulate in WhatsApp groups of active and retired military personnel. Moise's death follows a spate of high-profile killings in Haiti, including those of a journalist and a human rights activist, and months of gang violence, which has been compared to an undeclared civil war. Haiti's government has requested the United States send troops to protect key infrastructure. Coronavirus cases are finally dropping in Colombia. The average number of new daily cases is now at near 20,000, having risen to over 30,000 at the end of last month. Around 25% of the population has now had at least one dose of vaccine. 15% is fully vaccinated. Colombia has now suffered 112,000 deaths in a population of around 50 million. Those were your top stories for the week. Now back to Colombia Calling with Richard McCall.
And we're back. This is the Colombia Calling podcast, episode 384. I'm here in Mompox, and our very, very special guest in the flesh here in Mompox is none other than Emily Hart, who has just read you the news. So she's here in Mompox, and she's on the Colombia Calling podcast. Welcome.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. It's a real pleasure. Now, well, first of all, we know one another in the flesh. This has never happened before. It's all been a remote, a friendship, a working relationship over the ether.
More than a year.
I am immensely grateful and eternally indebted for your, the newscast that you provided. And we've only received positive feedback. Only negative feedback was that you were too English. Is that negative? I don't know. I don't think so.
I think I'm guilty without any recourse to fixing it. I did have a glorious piece of bad feedback from one man on Twitter. Thank you to this man. I won't name him. That I had my pronouns in my bio, and therefore he would not be listening.
You had your pronouns in... Okay.
Yeah, too woke, too modern, too... Who knows? But I have to say I found it rather flattering.
I think I did see that. I might have seen that.
I think you might even have seen...
It's possible, I think.
It really made my day. So.
I also had someone also tuning out because one of my interviews had said that Black Lives Matter.
Gosh, controversial.
And the person went, well, because that interviewee has BLM in their Twitter handle, I won't be listening.
I wonder if it's the same bloke just scouring Twitter handles to avoid podcasts.
There's probably a group. And then they've probably got a forum, you know.
Fantastic.
A Reddit page of hatred. because that's where the hatred lives, you know. But anyway, we're here. We're here in Mompox. First and foremost, let's big up Mompox a little bit. How have you been finding the last few days?
It's beautiful. Loving it. Very hot.
Yeah.
But pleasurably so.
Yeah.
Went on a tour of the Cienega, saw 50 different birds. I couldn't now name one of, but all beautiful. No. I have loved it.
And you've had you've made some friends. You've had we can't call it a romantic tryst, but you've made a friend who was clearly trying to impress you.
He certainly drove me about the Cienega during the sunset, which was fantastic. There were sort of enormous thunder and lightning on our right over fields of fireflies. Mm. Sort of as the sun was going down. Beautiful. Big fan.
There you go. There's a little spark in your eye there for a little Mompox story for you. I would mention that we have had marriages. We've had Canadian backpackers getting on the bus here in Mompox and being sat next to boys from El Banco and ended up marrying them. So there you go. Two backpacker friends married two boys from the same town.
I have to say, I do. Surprised if that was how this one turned out, but it was a nice couple of hours.
I think so. Well, he certainly showed you some of the countryside and some great Mompoxino hospitality, and isn't that nice?
Let's say so.
Yeah. Well, I thought we would. Well, we got get the trivialities out of the way. It's a pleasure to have you here, really. And it's, of course, I know I've had people on the podcast or listeners saying, who is this Emily Hart? We should hear from her as well, the news segments and so on. So rather than just having, you know, a newsreader, you're now a guest here.
I know, at risk of completely destroying my journalistic credibility via my personality.
I
am slightly
think
concerned
so.
I'm about to detonate the whole thing. But
I don't think so. You can.
And hopefully not.
Highly recommended by Adrian Alsimer. He was the one. He said, I can't do it anymore. I can't do it. I don't have any time. And I said, well, can you find someone? He just went, Emily Hart. I mean, there was no one else. So there you go.
That's fantastic to hear.
And so I've read most, if not all, of the bylines that aren't blocked by firewalls.
God, I know.
And there's some great stuff there. There's some great stuff that we can start with. Just talk journalism, I think, for the next sort of half an hour or so. You've got some stuff coming out, which we'll talk about to promote. But you write for The Telegraph, and you've written for Pitchfork and The Sunday Times, and I guess The Culture Trip, I want to say.
Yes, yeah, a while back.
Yeah. When it was around and we could enjoy culture.
Yes, quite. When culture and trips were allowed, that was when I wrote for them.
I wonder about these websites, you know. It's like, I guess they're all putting back together now. Where are the next places to travel? Where are the safest places to travel?
I think they are re-expanding, but certainly my contract with them is not.
No, really. But so tell us a little bit. I mean, Emily, you're from the UK, you're from London. How did you choose just to end up in Medellin?
I have to say, all roads lead back to Adrian, which I don't often say, but it is true in this case. I had a friend who had worked with Columbia Reports on his year abroad,
mm-hmm.
who had told me a million and one anecdotes, which range from brilliant to bizarre about working with Adrian. And I was very curious, and I had been... I trained as a journalist, but not really committed to it, and I was backpacking in Mexico. I must have been in my fourth month. I mean, I'd nearly reached the USA at this point, top to bottom. And I gave Adrian an email and said, do you fancy having me in the newsroom for a bit? And then from Tijuana, I flew to Medellin.
From Tijuana, there are flights... Well, via Mexico City.
Because
I'd be very worried, given the relationship between certain areas of Mexico and certain areas of Colombia.
There are certain custom blocks between those two places,
Well, that's cool.
Yeah, and then that was 6 months, and I was sort of hooked after that. And I've been here on and off ever since.
So I was in contact with Adrian today, and that's why I got my phone here, like a good Colombian reporter. He learned the most interesting thing. This is just to show you how off the wall. Out of nowhere, I get this message from Adrian saying, I've always had this thing for Taoism and Kung Fu from Wudan that both turn out to be perfect to learn how to walk again. As if you didn't know, he broke his ankle recently.
Yeah.
I can actually use Kung Fu techniques and Taoist thought experiments to recover my mobility. I never imagined this. And that's it. That's the conversation. I mean, that's how random Adrian is.
I'm so fond of Adrian, but physio is also a thing. And if you're listening, try that first before Kung Fu.
It's Adrian. I expect this totally from Adrian. And, he's the kind of person that I could have weeks of no communication and then he'll just send me a link saying, you should read this or something.
It is fantastic, and the depth of knowledge. Mm. And I think that's how I became hooked on the stories and story of Colombia. Is you can name a person to Adrian and he will tell you the full history of their crimes, alleged and even more alleged.
Yeah.
It is extraordinary, the amount of stuff in there.
We need to delve into this a little more, though. I mean, working for Adrian, it must be an experience. I mean, I think it's probably a good way of cutting your teeth, because he's definitely one to say, listen, this is the story, you know, get out there, do this, do some proper legwork in the street.
Yeah, and, you know, check your sources.
Yeah.
I think he was once genuinely cross with me, and rightly so, because I wrote a piece based on one source. Which you just don't do, and I should not have done.
Mm.
You know, I was early career, let's say. I was early career. And we did. We conflicted a lot. Lots of good discussions about gender. I don't know if... Yeah, it's clear that I'm a woman, but I am one. And I was in a newsroom with two men. And we were, both interns at that time, were churning out 3 articles a day.
Mm.
But they were well discussed. We bounced things off each other. If something, you know, didn't go down well with someone, it would be in discussion. It was a really good experience. And it was my first, you know, real newsroom experience. Mm. I had worked on the Hampstead Highgate Express.
I noted that on your website.
Yes, which my greatest piece was about the Druids celebrating the equinox. Some of my least good were about, you know, lunchtime on a Tuesday dog yoga. It's a very bougie part of London, and the opportunity for hard-hitting journalism, I wouldn't say it was, you know, it was what characterised my time there. So to work in Adrian's newsroom was something very distinct.
Well, you're always going to get more hard-hitting, I think, out of Medellin than Hampstead.
Than Hampstead, yeah.
Hampstead dog yoga. Although I presume there's dog yoga in Medellin. I mean, I presume there is. It's quite forward-thinking.
I would have thought so. I think such that one of my teachers at journalism school heard my accent and thought, yes, you should go and report on Hampstead. And, you know, fair play. I know how I sound. Yeah. Very English as well.
We've all got crystal accents here. It's fine. But I think, you know, you go from one experience to the next. An experience like Adrian and churning out three pieces a day is, you know, proper hands-on experience. And, of course, getting the right amount of sources. And I've known of other people who have done their... what do you call it, their experience work, their internships with Adrian, and they all speak well of it. They all do. So.
And it's a fantastic community. Yeah. You know, I meet people all the time in Medellin who did their time with Adrian. He's a sort of Medellin journalistic godfather.
Definitely.
I hope he'll find that flattering. I'm not sure.
Well, I will ensure that he listens to this one. I mean, I know he doesn't listen to all of them, but I will ensure that he listens to this one. So then, let's ask, is how did you make, and of course, we are in Colombia, there's always going to be a barking dog or a motorcycle in the background. In fact, I know for a fact that this dog back out there is in heat, because she's kept us awake for a couple of nights.
I'll be taking another way home then.
Actually, I was in a store yesterday, and they had a bucket of sulfur in dust on the floor, and I said, what's this sulfur for? And she went, this is what you put on your dog when it's alborotado, and so when it's in heat, so you put the sulfur. So I could have picked them up. Never mind. That's a side story. While I am on the story of journalism and reporting, so how did you make the jump? And it's quite a significant jump, you know, from Adrian's newsroom, respectful, you know, very widely read, respected, to the demolition of Escobar's. Was it, what's it, the house? Was it Monaco? Monaco building.
Edificio Monaco.
And you did this for the Times.
I did.
This is a big jump.
It was, and it felt at the time like a miraculous jump. And I did everything you're not supposed to do, is the answer. I decided I would go to this event. Uh-huh. I'd heard from another journalist, the mayor was throwing a party. The demolition of a building, which I thought in itself sounded silly, and I like things that are silly. Okay. I like to laugh. Things that are funny are almost always my priority. Adrian, I'd already written something on this. He didn't want it at all. This was something I shouldn't have been doing. I wasn't at this event. And it was gloriously ridiculous. Mm. All of Medellin's elite were there, fully made up, you know, heels, suits, all the best and whitest linens one could imagine. Mm. String quartet, tiny canapes. Mayor reads sort of sweatily and fumblingly a 40-page A4 sheet.
Okay.
Which is, you know, humorous in itself.
Yes.
He comes to the end of this speech about how, you know, Medellin is no longer a narco city, and how that era is over, and the demolition of this building is a symbol of that. Mm. Bashes a button. The building falls. I've never heard a sound like it.
Yeah.
And suddenly this entire golf club is full of dust. And the string quartet is playing blind. We're all blinded. These women are sort of pulling eyeliner and dust out their eyes. The canapes are covered in dust. And I couldn't stop laughing behind my dust mask. I mean, you're given 8 pieces of merch and a dust mask that makes, you know, a construction worker's dust mask.
But this was clearly an afterthought, was the dust mask. I mean,
absolutely,
they would not have planned to say, we're going to have you in within the dust cloud of the destruction.
I don't think they thought it through at all. I thought the mayor's office has a PR person who doesn't know very much about building demolition. Is that Columbia scoring?
That's Columbia scoring again. We're recording this on Friday evening, everyone.
Anyway, so I went to a cafe afterwards and wrote in my journal. Yeah. And you know, I very occasionally look at my own work and think that's not garbage. So I typed it up, and against all advice I've ever been given, quite rightly, I sent it whole, in the first person, to the deputy editor of the Times.
And they picked it up. I mean, you didn't have any inroads there. You didn't
Nothing.
Know people. And
no, just... no introduction. Just, hello.
See, I'm 44, turning 45, and I'm jealous.
I fear if you've got, you know, unfortunately, and I have very much tried to break away from any narrative involving Escobar since, but if you do have Escobar in your pitch line, you know, and obviously they changed it out of the first person, thankfully, when they printed it, so that it seemed more like journalistic work. But I think I got very lucky.
Yeah.
You know, it was an event that was absurd, and it went in the From Our Correspondent.
Oh, there. Good
yeah, one. So it was in print, which was nice, but yeah. I think that particular column looks for things that are personally reported. So
oh, definitely. I'm envisaging now that string quartet in sort of like a comedy movie or something, when someone drops a whole load of flour on a string quartet and they, you know, sort of wiping it out of their eyes and still trying to play.
It was terrible. and the canapes were grey. Like, it was just the most unbelievably poorly thought through event I've ever seen. And the idea that the destruction of a building, which is an incredibly loud, unglamorous, dusty, functional occurrence, they had tried to heighten it to metaphor. And I think the failure of that, it brought me joy, especially having been subjected to 484 pages of mayoral speaking.
And it's just, but it's... You know, you're not removing the events of extreme emotional importance that have taken place there by destroying
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely, but neither. The truth is, I then did more research into it, and the fact of it was that they were unable to renovate it. It was cheaper to demolish it. But the useful narrative is, you know, we are renewing the city, blah, blah, blah. And you know, you look around at the people there and you think, you have this man's money in your pockets.
I was going to say that.
The very
elite.
Yeah, you know, Senora, the tightness of your forehead was paid for in part by the money of the man whose end we are supposed to be celebrating here.
At the very least, the fashion sense is inspired by the quick money that was involved. At the very, I think there's a lot that can be picked apart.
Mm.
But I do think, okay, demolish it, and then what? But does it need to be a high society event?
This is what made me laugh, the contrast that the whole thing was so, so silly. And you think, could that money have been better spent remunerating the victims of the many, many crimes of this man? You know, the fact that Medellin is no longer living through the 80s and 90s is a good thing, but to pretend that the chapter is completely closed is sort of crass, totally crass, if not entirely facetious by the mayor and his PR office.
This Edificio Monaco, do we know when it was built? Do you have that off the top of your head? Do you know any of your I was going to wonder if there's asbestos in it, because if you're looking at the canapes with this grey dust. Hey, you know, it was an afterthought, the masks.
Yeah, I mean, the masks were about as glamorous as the dust covered quartet, I'll be honest. I mean, just wild.
But that, I mean, still, a huge story to get out there, and maybe you exercise the having to mention Pablo Escobar. It was obviously a piece about him. We've all had to do it. We've all had to put Colombia so long, the byword for kidnapping and cocaine under the narco-terrorist regime of Pablo Escobar. We've all had to do it at some point or another. And I think that's where a lot of my articles start going down, is that I will refuse to put that in a pitch line anywhere. And I will
think,
I do not deny that there is a relevance to Pablo Escobar, but there are other cartels, and there's also, you know, a complete evolution in the style of these, they call them now like newly armed groups or whatever, or illicit groups. Yeah. We know what they are. I mean, but there's a different style to it now. But moving on, though, because you've done some, I mean, you've jumped around. This is what I like the most, is that, you know, and then I see you're on, you know, you've got an awesome piece on Chiribiquete, where Prince Charles went.
Did he?
No less, with President Santos.
God.
They flew him out on a helicopter and landed on the top of one of those sort of tabletop mountains for him to look at the nature.
And they had to bring him back, did they?
Oh, yeah, they bring him back. Yeah.
That's where it went wrong. Yeah.
Well, he could have come with me several years before and gone up the river with a bunch of friends and a boat driver who was in the FARC. And as we went up the river, he said, oh, yeah, over here, we didn't know who he was at this time. Mm. Over here, we had Ingrid for a few days. That's where you're like, I'm going 4 days up a river with this guy. And that night, we saw the bombing of the forest taking place, not far from Chiribiquete, because we were within the national park, but from the southern end, and they were bombing, and, well, the government, or the Ministry of Defense back then, under the presidency of Juan Manuel Santos, said they had killed a top-ranking guerrilla called Fabian Ramirez, who then turned up in Cuba for the peace accord. So he obviously hadn't been bombed.
It's not the most successful killing I've heard of, I'll be honest.
I think they bombed a lot of trees, is what has happened. But anyway, this Chiribiquete, give us a little bit of a background about it, because it is a phenomenally interesting story.
Yeah, I went to a talk at the Hay Festival, who have a chapter, actually two chapters here in Colombia. Gosh, I think it might be three now. A number of chapters here in Colombia by Carlos Castaño Uribe, who is the top archaeologist on this, as well as an anthropologist. And he is, I have to say, initially I was captured by him. He's known as the Indiana Jones of Colombia. Mm-hmm. And all of his early adventures are sort of him hanging out of a helicopter by a string. He's got a little blow-up boat on his back. He comes face-to-face with real jaguars, all of which was inevitably cut from the article. But, like, I really found him as a figure and this kind of just deep sense of adventure. Mm. And he was abseiling down a cliff and found himself face-to-face with two enormous red paintings of jaguars, which were what he had been hunting for, because he'd seen a smudge on a cliff face a week before, probably while hanging out of another helicopter, and decided he wanted to go and see it. So the story was always for me through his eyes. Of course, local communities, particularly indigenous ones, knew about the paintings at every moment since their execution, which was 20,000 years ago, some of them.
Wow.
Which is extraordinary. And they know that because they've done carbon dating on the paint, but also because there are animals in these paintings that are from the Ice Age.
So you've got, like, woolly mammoths and things.
They've got giant sloths.
Wow.
Which have not been around for a while. Yeah. Certain breeds of giant horse. There's sort of no doubt of when they're from, because the fauna that they depict no longer exists. Quite aside from that, I, grew up on Roman myths and Greek myths, mm-hmm. Sort of read them by my parents, obsessed by them, mm-hmm. and there's this whole world of mythology that's mm-hmm. come out of the Chiribiquete paintings and the ones surrounding it, about particularly the jaguar, which is at the centre of the cosmology, and the jaguar is the sun of the sun and the moon. Mm-hmm. So he's yellow on the top and white underneath. And he's got these circles which, represent both. And he is the perfect balance of those two forces, of the masculine and the feminine. And he exists in the world to keep balance.
Yeah.
Just sort of fascinating.
It is fascinating.
Figure. And the jaguar is, who you are seeking when you you take a psychedelic shamanic trip.
Uh-huh. So like a yahe or ayahuasca.
Right, yeah, and these paintings depict plants that we now recognise to be those plants.
So the vines.
Yeah, because the jaguar men, as they're known now, who painted these were not, they were a nomadic group, mm-hmm. and they were effectively a shamanic group, mm-hmm. Who went into the area to paint these things. Right. They didn't live in the area, they found no bones, no remnants of any sort of settlement, because this area is seen as incredibly sacred.
Yeah.
It is where, the spirits live. So you wouldn't live in there. And local communities don't want to live in there. Carlos found trouble getting taken in there. I found myself very, very captured by the mythological world that was conjured by these paintings. And also because it was not only a story about Colombia that didn't involve the above named, and because it was an ecological story, so it's got a really big deforestation problem. That Frontera Colono, the point at which deforestation is occurring, is creeping very quickly towards, you know, patrimony and sort of all of our heritage, because these are some of the first people to be on this continent.
That's it, isn't it? It's that nomadic group wandering through, and that's what I was sort of taken by, the first, you know.
Yeah, who arrived possibly through the European continent across the Bering Strait and came down,
amazing,
probably through the mountains, down to Colombia.
What is being done, if anything, then, to halt this deforestation, this colonial frontier that keeps getting pushed and pushed?
I mean, there are fantastic NGOs and groups trying to fight it and raising awareness, and there's some fascinating satellite imaging.
Hmm.
There's a few groups that are doing incredible things to track it with satellites. The problem is that it is all bound up with illicit trade of various types.
Yeah.
One can grow initially cocaine, and then one can farm palm oil, and then you can graze cattle in a way that later enables you to take title of that land, because you are using it for agriculture. So it ties into numerous semi-legal and not legal activities, and therefore there are very powerful people and large amounts of money behind the deforestation, which makes it very difficult to stop, quite aside from the fact that, you know, Colombia is still a very centralized country, and this is a very, quote-unquote, peripheral, I hate the word, but geographically,
brilliant,
is where we're at.
So,
you know, the government is less present there.
Well, state presence is a small military base somewhere nearby, on the river, nominally to, let's say, on the Yari or the Pesai rivers down there, or the Caquetá River, to nominally stop the extraction of, you know, precious metals or coca paste from areas. Nominally.
Mm.
I mean, that's it. There's a whole lot more problems, but you see it when you see it down there, and again, peripheral. Yeah, I mean, it is, because it's just not on a central government's map. It's not to be, you know, we see things that happen on the Magdalena River, let's say, but the Magdalena River is, you know, passes 8 million odd people at some point or another, so people know, you know, but down there you don't. I mean, that's the reality of Colombia when you look at the map and say, well, one third is really populated, and then that whole swathe down to Brazil, tiny border with Peru and then Ecuador. It's just not.
No, and the traffic of goods through there, I mean, illegal gold coming in and out of Brazil is a huge problem.
Yeah.
A few activists working down there told me they spotted members of the Sinaloa cartel. I mean, really the level of anonymity and lack of accountability down there enables it to be a real center of international movement of stuff we ought to be tracking. So...
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, I would see that the only way is if there is more international cooperation towards it. But of course, then the powers that be, or the very big names or families or entities, aren't going to want that. I mean, it's the same story repeated dozens, if not scores of times in Colombia. I mean, unfortunately so. Moving on then, because I love it. You did a breaking news story, which is pretty another big deal. A breaking news story for the Telegraph at the beginning of the pandemic here, and no one else had it.
Yeah, it was a big one, and it was a good one to tell, but it was horrible. I mean, it was one of those times when a source sends you something horrible and says, do something. Please let people know about this. And it was, you know, three lines of information and seven pictures of recently deceased bodies, which will impel you to do some stuff like that.
Yeah.
That will make you stand up and pay attention.
So I
started. On a pamphlet, there was a picture, sort of crumpled picture of a FARC pamphlet. Or FARC dissident group, and it was saying, you know, this is our quarantine. These are the rules that we are putting into place for coronavirus, and these are the penalties if you do not comply. And they, you know, certain groups were coming across bars that had a couple of people in them after 4 p.m. and throwing grenades into them. These were, you know, this was not quarantines as the government was setting them in any country.
So you've got dissident groups and armed groups.
Yes.
Enforcing both, a quarantine.
Yes, both groups identified as, you know, paramilitary and groups identified as FARC dissident groups were behaving in the same way. It was to some an opportunist way to take more control of the population and also to keep them inside so that there were less witnesses to activity.
And where was this taking place?
Actually, all over the country in the end. I collected about 20 pamphlets. And the language of them was just
brutal.
Spine-chilling. Really spine-chilling. But in lots of places and with a real variety of groups, actually. And one of my favourite outlets here, Sia Vasia, really helped me out with a few pamphlets they collected as well.
Okay.
So we kind of put together about, I think it was more than 20 in the end. It was really happening pretty widely and, you know, in the mindset of an armed group, obviously, you know, it's a great opportunity.
It seems to me like, I mean, talking that sort of from an editorial perspective, it's the type of story that I would, you know, if I came across it, I would do and would be tough, let's say, to get into the British press. For me, I mean, it's, first of all, Columbia, but then it would be kind of timely in that it's the pandemic and it's a different slant on it. But, I mean, you got it in there, which is the key thing. But I guess, I mean, I think we spoke about this at another point but, off mic, but it was just a question of getting it published because you felt so responsible.
I think that is it. And knowing, you know, this particular source, I'm not going to describe anything about his life, but I know that he doesn't have contact with other journalists.
Okay.
He would not have reached out to a bunch of people. This was an email sent just to me. And, you know, full disclosure, I was at this point in the UK, where I had gone back for, you know, family and health reasons at the beginning of the pandemic. So I was doing some weird hours, but I was very determined. And, you know, not because I'm like a fantastically hard-headed journalist.
Yeah.
That level of, you know, violent imagery and the tone of desperation, I absolutely felt I had to get it out. And, you know, fortunately, one of the foreign editors of The Telegraph, who is pretty receptive to Columbia stories, and, you know, is generally communicative and quite fantastic, was very keen to have it. And, I think when you're living in a quarantine and everyone was like, this is the worst thing to ever happen, to be able to be like, hey, guys,
this is worse.
I can think of something worse. Oh, look, it's nonfiction.
Yeah.
You know, I think for that reason, it was a quote-unquote winner for the editorial.
Those pamphlets, though, we've had them. I mean, they do get delivered around Montfort in December and January for the annual social cleansings. And they are just the most, as you said, sort of chilling documents. A friend of mine who was working at Peace Brigades, they got pamphleted, and she sent me the pamphlets, and she's like, you know it's true. That's the thing.
Absolutely. These are not empty threats. Although, you know, there's a small black comedy element when you realise how many misspellings there are in them. There was one I read that had misspelled the word guerrilla. It had one R in it. And it's got a dateline as though it's a formal letter, and it just says FARC guerrilla spelt wrong, and then Las Montañas, like that's their address.
I know they put that on the bottom of,
right, just like there's something like so, you know, there's a very hollow arrogance to it. And yes, you know, they do have a certain level of power, but the sort of aggrandizement of it,
That were always the, let's say, the statements that they used to release when they had a website back in the day and stuff. It was De las Montañas de Colombia. Always ended in, and you're like, yeah.
It's like, oh, can we get a postcode? Like, that's the format of a letter.
But it's hard work.
Oh, it was sickening, yeah. I struggled really to read those pamphlets. They are...
It's hard. It's
just,
too much.
You know, the most violence I've ever come across in language, if I'm honest. And, you know, knowing that these are not just words.
But then this feathers in quite nicely if we're just talking about words here and words and style and stylistic, to going from something incredibly violent to something not quite so violent, talking about how you've jumped around. I mean, I did read an incredibly interesting piece in Pitchfork. Now, Pitchfork is a music, I think, online journal is the way I would put it.
Yeah,
and it sort of became one of the most sort of credible places for music reviews a while ago when it came out, and people would all go there for their music reviews. But you've written long form journalism for them.
Yes, I have neither excuse nor explanation. Yeah. I have long been a fan of a genre known vaguely as rainforest electro.
Okay.
And that makes it sound terrible, but please click on some of the links in my piece, because it is fantastic music, I promise, and I'm going to undersell it horribly. But I was at that point in the pitching cycle, which I'm sure, you know, you will recognise, where you are trying to come up with ideas, and you would sell your own arm. So I began to cannibalise my personal interests, and thought, maybe this music is interesting in a way that isn't just like me at my desk. And fortunately, you know, it is. It's got, you know, it's region-wide, this piece. So I spoke to producers here and in Argentina and in Ecuador, sort of all over, who are part of the scene, and they recognize themselves as such. And they work the sounds of the landscape into their music.
So rainforest electro,
yes.
I'm going to say in the most brutal fashion, is it you're sampling birdsong?
So some of it is sampling birdsong.
Okay.
And honestly, some of my favourite ones are sampling birdsong.
There you go.
I think it's great. There's actually two albums by some producers called Shika Shika,
okay.
Both of which raise money for conservation. So that's the sort of obvious end. And then there's artists like El Búho.
The owl.
The owl, yeah. Yes. Better in Spanish, one feels, who's actually British and who used to work for Greenpeace. So it's sort of very ecologically minded, and he will record the sea and then sort of bend and stretch those noises until they become an entire orchestra. Percussion, string, and it's all effectively sort of warped and edited sea sounds.
Is it like when you, slow down a vinyl?
Yes,
on on the turntable.
Right,
yeah, okay.
And then the crashing of a wave, really, really condensed, will sound like a hi-hat.
Yeah.
So there's a sort of enormous range of things that are being done, but as far as these artists see, they root their music in this continent, because obviously electro is seen to be something, you know, Berlin, London, New York, and they wanted not to imitate, but to create something that genuinely has roots where they have roots.
So I heard this last Christmas, the nephew of a friend of mine, so obviously completely out of my age range, talked about, what was it called? Desert House.
Desert House?
Yeah, see, I have no idea what that
new
is.
New ecosystem plus musical genre. Yeah, yeah, into it.
It's like,
I'll
what
give
are
it
you
listen.
Listening to? Desert House. And I was like, I don't dare ask.
No,
it's like, oh,
I mean,
oh, very good.
Interesting. I mean, what grabbed me about this story was Simon Mejia, who is the founder of Bomba Stereo.
Yes.
So he went on a journey through Colombia, taking sound recordings, and, you know, later turned them into music, and went to various, you know, very rich, quite loud ecosystems. And that is the thing about, you know, these forests and these coastal places in Colombia, is such a part of the experience of being there is the sound texture. And I think the integration of that into music gives it a very specific character.
It can be cacophonous. I mean, if you're there and you let them, I mean, it can be really deafening.
Yes, I think the skill Simon has is extracting certain parts of it in order to create music around it.
Well,
and, you know,
you know, I think it's fascinating. I mean, you've really, as I said, you jumped around, you know,
yes,
from gorillas and the pandemic, from...
Something of a magpie. If it's shiny, I'm going to fly at it. And, you know, I'm in the fortunate position as a freelancer. I've got nobody telling me what to write, which at times is obviously terrifying, because it means there's nobody paying you to write at all times. But it enables you this range, and I, you know, I've had some very generous editors who've allowed me a lot of, you know, trust and left in extraordinary lines that I only really wrote to sort of please myself, and sometimes they leave them in and you're like, God, did I want that going public?
Did they even read it?
Did they even read it? I have occasionally asked myself that, yeah. But
You've got something new coming up, another long-form piece, 11 short pages.
11 pages.
Where can we find it?
So this is in a magazine, which if you haven't come across, you must seek out, called Delayed Gratification.
Delayed Gratification.
Yes, and they are part of a movement that they call Slow News.
All right.
So they take a 3-month period, and they will publish on it 3 months after it finishes.
Hmm.
Their tagline is, last to breaking news. So the idea is you get something really analysed, really considered, but, you know, it just doesn't pop up on your Twitter and it goes in one ear and out the other. Mm-hmm. It's real long form, and I've been a huge fan of theirs for a very long time.
But it must be only by subscription then, this one, because are you going to find it on
you
a
can
shelf?
Buy it in, yeah, you can buy it in newsagents.
Oh, really?
I'm afraid probably only in the UK.
Yeah.
They do, however, have a blog on which they publish their big features. So hopefully this will be online on their website in a month or so. So this was... I mean, you know, I'm sort of hoping desperately that my career isn't peaking. But getting 11 pages of a magazine that I love, getting to write about the LGBTQ community in Colombia, which as a member of that community globally is very important to me, and getting to, you know, really describe the people that you're talking about, and then also give a potted history of Colombian conflict for a good... three pages. So yeah, it was a real experience in writing. It's about 5,000 words, all in all.
It's a good chunk. I know then, you know, I've seen the PDF, but we've gone, won't really reveal. But it's based in a small town in Antioquia, so where Medellin is based.
Yes.
Called San Rafael.
It's called San Rafael.
And you are delving into the LGBTQ
history,
community.
Yeah. Okay. So I, in El Espectador, I read two lines of a piece about a gay collective called the Chrysalis Collective, who were launching a report to the HEP about the Transitional Justice Court about their experience in conflict. And I thought, that sounds really interesting. And I looked them up, and they're just a journalist.
Oh, really?
Just they're fantastic. Their personalities are so manifest. They speak beautifully. And I ended up in San Rafael for the launch of their novel, which is a fictionalized version of what they lived through during the paramilitary occupation of San Rafael. And San Rafael, in the hills around the town, had been a FARC rearguard area since the 80s. And the AUC, the Metro Block, arrived. They threw flyers out of a helicopter to announce their arrival. Which, you know, again, the theatrics of these groups is never-endingly astounding. And then they occupied the town for a number of years, and the paramilitary groups, identifying with a far-right social politics, and a, let's call it, particular brand of masculinity, treated this collective very differently than had FARC, who had largely left them alone. And this, you know, this group was flourishing. They were, in Antioquia, not an easy feat integrating into the mainstream society. They were organizing events. San Rafael became known as San Rafa Gay in parts of Antioquia. Such was the reputation of this group. And, you know, the paramilitary effectively put an end to that, and the group are now telling their story, and I was just, you know, profoundly inspired by them, which is always a good start with sources.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the piece itself, quite aside from the length of it, was a rough ride, as anyone I live with will tell you, because I got commissioned, and then I got COVID. I went, and then I got gastritis, which I won't go into detail about, but you can imagine how that was. And then I was in the middle of an interview with the main source, and there was a 6.9 earthquake. So the recording is comical.
Yeah.
We're sort of talking very seriously about what are war crimes and recognised as such. And suddenly we're both running into the doorway. But being a small town, most of the recording is like us in a doorway. And Botero, who is the most fantastically good-natured person I've ever met, greeting people in the square, waving as the earthquake continues. Which was mad. The next day, my other main source's mum died, so our interview is postponed. I just about get home, another week of gastritis, and then I sit down sort of triumphantly to write this piece with my like little Bluetooth detached keyboard, and I start like tapping away, like Sam Raphael, amazing, I'm ready to go, 5,000 words. And termites come pouring out of my keyboard. And I'm not talking a couple, like so many termites. And I'm just convinced it's cursed at this point. I'm not a superstitious person, but we're talking like the plagues of Egypt have been put upon me in my attempt to write about the gay community in Antioquia. However, finally, 3 months later, it's out, and it's got some of my photos of the guys in the collective, which are, you know, you can tell by looking at them. They're fantastic, and they're, you know. This novel is available online if you're a Spanish speaker, called Crisálida, and it was funded by one of the many arms of Colombian conflict justice.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a wonderful object, and it was co-written by members of the collective. Yeah. They're now 90 people strong. You know,
that's a huge group in a small town.
Yeah, I know. I mean, Chrysalis is more than a metaphor. Mm. They are rebirthed, and it's really cool to see. And San Rafael's a beautiful little place, but you're not sat there thinking, this is the home of radical gay politics in Antioquia.
I suppose it has to be somewhere. I don't know.
It has to be somewhere, but you sit and it's Vuelteaos and Tintos and Vallenato, and the clock has read 10 to 10 since nobody knows when. And it's the sort of thing I become mildly obsessed with as a detail, because I did spend a lot of time in the square drinking tinto with anyone who would sit down and tell me about the history of the town. And I asked a lot of people. Mm. Nobody can remember how long it has been 10 to 10 in San Rafael.
Wonderful.
I mean, you can't beat it.
I love that kind of thing. I love observations that can be woven into a story, but to really set the scene.
Mm.
You know, obviously relevant observations. And of course, it's sort of the frozen in time type thing on the one side, but the progressive on the other.
Right. I mean,
because it's with a 90-strong collective, Chrysalis, that is progressive, and more so in Antioquia, which you would not ever have considered.
Right, and this was the launch of the book, was the procession of a quilt with the victims of the conflict. And then it's led into a square where extracts of a novel in which a man is dancing in drag doing Don't Cry for Me Argentina are being read.
And of course he is.
Of course, I mean, what else? It was that and ABBA.
Of course.
And I've completely fell in love with the story, and I'm eternally grateful that someone gave me the space to really write it.
That's amazing. Well, you see, the long form does exist. You've just got to find the right stuff in the right place, isn't it?
It does, and you know,
it's unfortunate. It has to be in the most, let's say, slightly specialised, almost. You know, sort of.
Yeah.
That we have to look for it. It can't be. But never mind. That's all for another story. That one. I'm sure we could go on.
I think as a journalist who really likes to get into a story, I mean, probably as all of us do, I've never been that drawn to the adrenaline fueled can you get this out? And I've done crime, and I found it a bit ephemeral. You do it and it's important for a minute and it's gone. And I think that's what I really respect about the slow journalism movement, is that these are stories that stick. You know, this is a magazine that I have. They come out quarterly, and I keep them, and they matter, and I remember stories.
It will stick around.
Right. I mean, I have my parents send it to me here. God knows how much that costs, given that it's printed on basically cardboard. worth the money. Yeah. It's a fantastic opportunity to get, I think.
Well, I think that the listeners now are going to be very pleased that they've got to know a little bit more about Emily Hart, who provides the excellent news week on the Columbia Calling podcast. I think it's important, you know, that we have cast the net wider to make sure they know who you are, and therefore it's a bit more of an appropriation for them knowing.
I hope they keep listening.
So thank you. Coming to Mompos.
I've loved it. Thanks for having me.
That's all right. Everyone's invited. But it's been a pleasure having you here. It's been my sons have spotted you around the town.
Always on the phone, they said. Your son said, I saw you. You were on the phone.
Yeah, about right. But that's, it's a small town. You see, nothing gets by.
I was
told the other day you didn't have breakfast.
I feel so terrible. I had a meeting. I'm sorry. I'm sure it was delicious.
It's all right. It was the same breakfast you had the day after.
Then it was definitely delicious.
But anyhow, that's another story. Listen, let me just take this time to say thank you so much again, because again, I know the listeners, my stepmother will say, she's listening in the US at the moment. She gets her Columbia news from you. So there you go.
Very flattered.
Yeah, and that's all she wants to really listen to. So there you go. We're gonna sign off now, but say thank you again to Emily for her time. That's Emily Hart, journalist, our news journalist, the researcher. And I would say, pretty exploratory stuff when you look at the different bylines that we've just been checking out in the last couple of years. So I think it's very cool indeed. So
thank you.
Thank you for your time.
And thank you for having me on.
Pleasure.
This has been great.
Episode 384 of the Columbia Calling podcast. And we'll be back next week. A very special guest will be Sharika Crawford, calling in from the USA, and we're going to be talking about the Caribbean and other elements of Afro-Colombian populations, I think. I think that's what it is. I have to research a bit more. So that's us for this week. Thank you again to all the listeners, and be sure to subscribe and share, as always. Bye-bye.